Okay, so hello and welcome for Computer Graphics. We are right now speaking about advanced ray tracing and a method I presented last time is called distribution ray tracing, and the idea I explained for the example that we want to render a material which is not perfect specular. And that means the reflection towards the viewer does not only depend on one single reflection ray, but in fact it depends on a number or on the entire region around the major reflection. And now the problem with ray tracing is that such a ray is always, it's just a single sample, it's just a single point, or it's not a point, but in a space, in a ray space, it would be a single point. So it only samples a certain direction, But in fact, we would have to integrate about this entire cone. And the idea of distribution ray tracing now is very simple. It just means if we have such a case, do not cast a single ray, but instead cast several rays and average their results. And because that problem happens or appears quite often, this glossy BRDF is just one instance of the very same problem. There are also other applications for this idea. And the first one I spoke about is anti-aliasing. And here the idea or the problem is that the color of a single pixel does not only depend on the color at certain points, but it depends, it's really kind of the average color over the entire pixel. And now what we can do is that in order to get nicer anti-aliased edges, for instance, we can try to sample that range. So we spoke about several methods. The first one is a uniform grid over the pixel. But we also saw other methods, for instance, randomly sampling within the pixel, a few different methods, to how to generate these samples. Okay, now a method or another point where this issue becomes interesting is depth of field. And now depth of field, the effect of depth of field is known to each one of you. So here we have I think that's also already slightly blurred. It's just not very well visible. But here we see a typical effect. And that's an effect that every camera and also the human eye has, and that is that you always have to focus to objects in a certain distance. That means if you look at these three spheres, for instance, in this example, the eye or the camera has been focused to the red sphere, and here it has been focused to the yellow sphere. And obviously, the further objects are away from this focus range, the more the objects are blurred. And now this is something that cannot be modeled by our pinhole camera model. Our pinhole camera model doesn't have something like blur. Every object, every sphere here would be a sharp sphere on the image plane. It's just a projection. So obviously our pinhole model is not sufficient to represent that. But also obviously this blurring here means it's again something like we saw before. It's a filtering about a certain range. The color of a pixel does not depend on a single ray but on multiple rays. Okay, so let's try to understand where this comes from and how that looks like. And the point is the following. In our pinhole model, we always assume, maybe you remember that model, that was also the first camera that has been built. It's a dark room, and then you have a small hole in one of the walls, and then an image is projected from the outside to the inside to the opposite side of that room. And here we assume that the hole is really infinitely small. And in fact, if we make that hole bigger, the image becomes brighter, but it also becomes blurrier. Because now, so this is our camera, And now if we have a small hole, then really everything outside here is perfectly projected to here. If we make that hole bigger, yeah, now you can quickly imagine that point here, or light emanating from here, will be projected to that spot here. Yeah? So a single point here is mapped to this entire spot. And this results in this blurriness. And the smaller this hole is, yeah, the smaller the spot is and the sharper the image is. And it's a trade-off. I mean, ideally, that hole would be infinitely small. then you have a perfectly sharp image, but it's black, yeah, because no more light gets through. And if you make it bigger, the image gets brighter, but it also gets less sharp. Okay, now, of course, also with a traditional camera, you have that problem. And this is now typically solved using a lens. And the idea of that lens now is that it kind of replaces this hole here, and it has the nice property that, now let's replace this hole with this lens. And now it has the nice properties that all the rays emanating from a certain point that hit this lens are refracted such that they get focused again here on the image plane. Yeah? So that's useful, no? Because now what we can afford, we have a larger hole, so we have a larger hole where light can come in, our image gets brighter, but it also gets sharp because this lens takes care of that. Yeah? But unfortunately, this does only work on a focus plane, so it only works in a plane that has a certain distance to the lens. And this focus plane can be moved. Yeah? Typically, you have you can change that focus plane with your camera, so you can move it forward and backward. And that's exactly what happened here. Yeah? Here, the focus plane is on the red sphere, so this one is sharp, and those in the back are unsharp. And now the focus has been changed. Now this is sharp, but this is less sharp. And your eye, by the way, does exactly the same. Okay, good. So this is how a lens can help, to make real photographs and to have a possibility to have a larger hole for light coming into the camera. But the price is that we have this focus problem. But one thing that is similar to this here, by the way, is that also for the lens now we can still typically change the hole size. For a normal camera, this is called aperture, so Blende in German. So there's a ring behind the lens, and you can change the size of that ring. And here now, exactly the same happens what happens here. So if the aperture is small, then you get more and more close to a pinhole camera, and the image typically gets sharper. And that means that the depth of field becomes wider. That means if you have a small aperture, you still can focus to the yellow sphere, but also objects that are in front or behind then get sharper. It's just this how fast things get blurry, this changes, yeah, with the aperture. And now these are effects that are typically used in photography, so it would be great to also be able to use them in computer graphics. Yeah, and it's very nice effects are possible with that, so it would be great if we would find a way to model that, and in fact, that's possible. I don't go into the technical details here because these lens systems here can become really complicated and so forth, but I think it's you can imagine that, assume you know the lens distribution. Assume you know the lens distribution, so you know the different lenses making that are in a camera, and for some simple cameras you can even download them on the web, and you know the optical properties of these material, then it's possible to cast eye rays through that. Yeah? And in fact, what you can do is that you take a particular pixel on the image plane, and then you cast rays onto the lens, towards the lens, yeah, to different positions on the lens. And from then on, you don't care anymore. Yeah? And now if your lenses are correct, then automatically all these rays will converge again here in the focus plane. Yeah? But it's ray tracing is just perfect to simulate such lens systems. You just cast several rays per pixel. Yeah? Now for every pixel, you do not cast a single ray through a pinhole or whatever, but instead you cast these rays onto the lens. And then you automatically get all these effects. Yeah? You cast many rays and you average them, and then you get one can get such nice images. Okay, so that's nice. But now, of course, again, we have the very same problem. Yeah? The illumination or the color of a particular point does not depend on a single ray, but instead, yeah, it really depends on an entire range of rays that all start here. Yeah, and we would like to follow all these. And of course, we cannot follow all of them because there are infinitely many, so we just take a subset of them and cast them and average them. Okay, so that's kind of second example, yeah? And I mean, you can also immediately see that this works nicely together with the anti-aliasing that we saw in the very beginning, because what we changed here, or what we change for anti-aliasing is the position on the sensor. Yeah, so we take a pixel on the sensor, and we jitter the original ray here. For depth of field, we also jitter the outgoing direction. Yeah. Okay. So that all just influences the generation of the eye rays. But of course, we can also go further. So the next step would be the distribution ray tracing that we saw in the very beginning. So this step here, yeah, now you have all these eye rays, and these are jittered along the reflection directions. And another point that we have to consider or can consider in that context are area light sources. So what's an area light? Area light, I think, is quite obvious. So the idea is that in reality, we do not have point lights as we use them in the Phong model or so. But a light source typically has some extent. Yeah? And this is important because, or it's particularly important because that means that the resulting shadows are soft. You do not have a binary transition from lit to unlit, but instead there's a ramp. Yeah, so you have a region where you have a soft shadow, a transition from in shadow to lit. And the size of this penumbra depends on the size of the area light and so forth. Yeah, so area lights are really necessary to generate realistic images. Okay, and now we have again the very same problem. Yeah, I hope you understand the idea meanwhile. So we have a point P that is to be illuminated. Now the illumination does not depend on a single ray to a point light source, yeah, or the shadow value, but it depends on many rays to the area light, yeah, or to the on the occlusion within the entire pyramid between that point and the area light, or cone, or whatever the area light looks like. Okay, so instead of casting a single ray, again, we can cast many rays, and thus approximate the illumination from that area light source. And of course, now the interesting point is to which positions on the area light do we cast our rays? Yeah? And the simplest way, probably, that everybody would do at the very beginning is just to, again, take a grid of points on the area light, yeah, and to say, okay, now my area light is replaced by these spots or by this many point lights, and we generate shadows, and yeah, this would result in an image like that. Yeah? And it looks interesting. but it's probably not what you want. Yeah. So what you see here is that obviously, or thinking a little bit about it, everybody will quickly realize that this is not an area light, but instead, it's a set of small point lights, and this results in this in these many shadows. Yeah, you see the single shadows of the single point lights up here. So, yeah, that's not a very good solution. And maybe you remember for the anti-aliasing, I also argumented that taking such a uniform grid to sample within the pixel, is not the best way. And here it's exactly the same. Yeah, the reason is maybe a little bit different, but also here these visible artifacts appear. Okay, so we can also try the other methods that we had for the pixel. Yeah, and the first one we were looking at was just random sampling, and in fact, here the result already becomes better. Now what happened here is that we take 32 samples on the light source, and these are distributed randomly. So we take random positions on the light. And in fact, we do not pre-compute 32 positions and use these for every single frame, because that would result again in these patterns. They would be less regular, but we could still see the single shadows. But instead, for every pixel down here, we take another new 32 samples randomly, and compute the illumination. Okay, now this gives us this result, and I think it also gets visible here on the projector that the price for this is that, it doesn't really look like a uniform object down here. Yeah, we see such a random pattern. And this, of course, comes from these random positions. And if you would do an animation of that, for instance, then things become worse because now there's no coherence. Yeah, for every pixel, or this noise also becomes temporal. You see that flickering. But what we can do, of course, is that we take more samples. Should have turned off the light. Yeah, so now here you see the difference. This is 128 random samples, so that's already quite a good solution. Yeah, but 128 is quite a lot. Yeah, so you might have to imagine that means for every point down here, we have to shoot 128 shadow rays. Okay, but I think I already mentioned that for high quality ray tracing, this is not an enormous number. So something like 1,000 or 2,000 secondary rays per pixel is nothing very special. Yeah, and yeah, so this is maybe a first example to see that. Okay, so now we saw a number of effects. We saw anti-aliasing on a pixel. Yeah, and I said this essentially means that for the eye rays, do not use a single center, but instead jitter this one. Yeah, jitter the starting point. Then for the depth of field, we use the lens system, and instead of taking a single ray towards our object, we also jittered these ray directions, to sample the lens. Again, the very same approach. Now such an object hits a glossy surface. And now instead of just taking a particular reflection direction, again, take more reflection directions, jitter around these. And to compute shadows from an area light, do not cast a single shadow ray, but instead, again, cast many of these shadow rays. Now you see, and all these steps that happen during a typical ray tracer, when we decide, okay, now we shoot one secondary ray, this distribution ray tracing means no, we should cast several secondary rays. But nevertheless, this can be well combined. So the naive approach now would be that we say, okay, instead of one array, we instead of one starting position, we take something like 8 starting positions. And for each of these 8 starting positions, we take 8 directions to sample the lens. Yeah? And now here, we take something like 20 directions to sample the incident light. Let's make it even recursive. So these hit these are diffuse, and for each of these, yeah, we cast all these rays to the light source, and we take 128 rays to the light source, as we saw before. Yeah, that means we get this quite enormous number of secondary rays. Yeah. So this is not necessary. Of course, it's much better to say, okay, for each of these, or let's say I take a certain budget of rays that I want to afford. So let's say something like 200. And now to determine the color of a single pixel, I just determine some random position on the pixel. Then I determine a random position towards the lens. For the hit point, I take one random reflection direction. And for that hit point, I take one random position on the light source. Yeah, so we do not, for every ray, or for every primary ray, we do not always spawn new rays, a large number of new rays, and these again spawn new rays, but instead, yeah, we always take one of these routes, and then we take another one, and so forth. Yeah, so we sample that entire space in parallel. We take one position on the pixel, one position on the lens, yeah, and so forth. So whenever we have that phase where we say, okay, now we should sample an entire range, we just take one direction in that range. And by this, we can sample all these effects in parallel. Yeah, we can generate anti-aliasing, depth of field, area light sources, and reflection directions, all this in parallel. Okay, now, normally, all these selections are done randomly. And this has a good reason. It's just because it's the by far simplest way. So I told you that using such a uniform grid here is visually typically not optimal, but we could, for instance, do a chittering on these points, a random chittering, so this kind of disturbs these regular steps, and we get a little bit more noise. But if you imagine these faces here, yeah, at every point, you have to make a new random decision, yeah, and this is by far most easy when using just such a random choice, yeah, and to say, okay, I take a random position here and then a random position here and so forth, yeah, and at sometimes rays, for instance, you will always have a refraction and a reflection ray, and yeah, so you have two rays, and for both of these, you would now have to find positions on the light sources, and they should be independent. Mutual independency should be maintained. All these things become very complicated if you try to do something smart. So random selection is typically the easiest way to do that. But the price for this, of course, is noise. Yeah, these images will always exhibit this salt and pepper pattern, but as we also can see here, that noise is typically much more better or much more acceptable for the eye than something like this here. Yeah? But nevertheless, ray tracing typically means cast many rays, and in the beginning, your images are very noisy, and if you are fine with the general setup, you have to spend time, and then the noise becomes less and less. And yeah, maybe just also as a little side remark at that place. So doing the sampling purely randomly, as I started explaining, is the easiest choice, but it has a very bad property in terms of convergence, and that's that the convergence of such a purely random estimator is 1 over square root of n. That means in order to halve your error, in order to halve your error, you have to take 4 times as many samples. Yeah? And that's quite painful. In fact, this regular sampling here has the error 1 over n, so it converges better. But it really has always these problems that instead of noise, you have steps in the solution, which is where the eye is very sensitive for. And here you have at least noise, but just in terms of convergence, it's quite slow. There has been quite some body of work on researching the space between regular sampling and purely random sampling. There are methods that are sort of in between. Yeah, so this is random. Uniform, here the error would be, that's uniform. And there are methods that are sort of in between. These are called pseudo-random. And these are kind of numbers that look rather random, but in if you draw many of these numbers, they rather uniformly sample the space. Yeah. I won't go into detail for that, but it's a kind of way to generate samples in space where for a large number of samples, you can guarantee that they rather uniformly sample the space, but only rather. They are random enough to have all the good probabilities of randomness, and they are uniform enough to have that convergence property. But the big disadvantage of these is that they are horrible to implement, because here one has to be careful that all these random or all these statistical decisions that are made for every reflection, for every point on the lens, for all these things, they all must be independent. And it's very, very complicated to keep track of these, and it's difficult to construct many sequences that are independent. For one or two is simple, but 20 is difficult, and so forth. Okay, but that's a very interesting big area of research. How to work in that context and how to decide about these directions and so forth. Okay, if you're interested in that, we have you're still in bachelor's, but or most of you, we have a project in the master where you have to implement a ray tracer, and there we come back to all these issues. So you might want to keep that in mind. There you can learn more about that. Okay, good. So that's distribution ray tracing. The basic problem is very simple. We are interested in averaging over entire cones or larger regions in space, but our ray tracer only is able to cast a single ray. So we always have the problem that we are undersampling. And now typically for eye rays, and if you have high resolution images, this is not very much a problem, because a pixel on the image plane is rather small, so that cone of directions that goes into the scene or this area here is quite small. So it's the error typically is not too big. Of course, it gets visible at silhouettes, but it's not that bad. things become quickly worse if you look at secondary rays. So as a simple example, let's look at this sphere here. And this is a mirror. And now we look at these rays, at the boundary rays through the pixel boundaries. And then you see now this lens, or this sphere here, acts a little bit like a lens. And these reflected rays now diverge even more than these original ones do. So the effect is that in order to determine the color for that pixel, essentially we have to integrate over that large area on this surface here. Yeah? So we have that problem that here these rays that are here still not diverging too much diverge even more here. Okay, now with our distribution ray tracing, we can handle that. I mean, in such a case, that would mean we need more rays, because we need more rays to sample that larger region. But it would be good to have kind of measure to find out or to measure that behavior. Here for this frustum here, or for this pixel, this is very simple. Yeah, we know we have a pixel here. This has some area. And now we can quickly estimate the further we get away from the camera, the larger this pyramid here spawned by the ray becomes. Yeah, and it's linear. So if we double the distance here, the area becomes fourfold, but the diameter becomes twofold. Yeah, so the diameter is linear. So that's quite simple, but here for that, things become difficult. Yeah, now here we somehow have to approximate how big this region here becomes after it has been reflected here at that sphere. And now this is something that we would like to keep track when doing ray tracing. And this is done using a tool which is called ray differentials. And the idea or the problem maybe can be shown here. So what we see here is a simple scene, and it's rendered by casting a single ray per pixel. And now, don't take care here of these glasses. They are not important for now, even if it looks like. The important part is the text here in the background, and here it is enlarged. And what you can see here now is that because we cast a single ray, we hit the paper here on a regular grid. And on each of these positions, we evaluate the texture. And we do not use MIP mapping or anything like that for now. We just take the color at that particular hit point. And you can see that the text becomes barely readable. And the reason, of course, is in fact that, again here, every pixel does not only consist of the center point, but it has some extent. And if we follow that ray here, now let's assume this sphere here is the paper, then we see within this pixel an entire quadrilateral of the paper becomes visible. Yeah, it's a kind of what in MIP mapping we described as the footprint of the pixel on the texture. So if this is our texture, the sheet of paper with written text on it, then a single pixel will cover a region on the paper like that. Yeah, of course smaller, but it's some rectangular, some quadrilateral on this paper. Yeah, and ideally the color of that pixel should be the average over that. Yeah, and what we do right now is that we just cast the ray in the center. So we just take the color here at that point. Yeah? And with the next pixel, we take a color here maybe, and then we take a color here. And this results in this image that we see here. And this is barely readable. And in fact, if we would do that filtering, like with MIP mapping, we would get a result that is unsharper, but that also looks better. I mean, I'm not sure whether it's really would be better readable, but it would be Yeah, more realistic. Okay. In fact, here for the glasses, they sort of compensate that because they focus the rays again. Yeah, it's like such a lens here. Yeah, all these rays going through the glasses are focused down here again. So that's why here, inside here, it looks great. Okay, and now this maybe also, even if that one here is okay, it maybe also again explains the problem. Because what we do in MIP mapping, it's rasterization, but it fits perfectly here. In MIP mapping, for that texture, we would decide that we do not use the fine texture, but instead we take a pre-filtered version. Yeah, so we take a coarser texture from our MIP map stack, just because this footprint here is so big. Yeah, and as a result, doing standard rasterization with MIP mapping, we would get a nice image here, yeah, with a filtered text. So that would work fine, but here for the glasses, it would not work. Yeah, because for the glasses, we have looking through these glasses, yeah, we would see exactly the same texture, and if we would apply that MIP map filter here, we would here see a very unsharp version of that, a blurred version. Yeah. Unnecessarily. The problem is the following. So here we have our camera. Here we have a single pixel. This is our sheet of paper. And the way we did MIP mapping, or we learned about MIP mapping, is that we approximate, or we compute, how large is this pixel here on the paper, and then we take a filter, or apply a filter that about roughly averages over this size here. Yeah? And the further the object away, the larger this filter will get. Yeah? Just because its size increases linearly. It's quite simple to write down formula for that. Now, if we have a lens in between, this doesn't work anymore. Because now these rays converge again. Yeah, and suddenly it can happen that here, yeah, these rays came together again. So here, we would now need a filter size of 0. And if we go further away again, then it increases. Yeah? So if we move the paper backward, now here suddenly we need a large filter. And if we move it forward, here we also again need a larger filter. Yeah, that's like this depth of field problem. Okay, so we would somehow need a way to be able when we follow rays, always for every point to approximate how wide is that current frustum of rays at that position. Yeah? So if we remove the lens here, yeah, if we cast that ray and we hit paper here, then we can quickly determine, okay, now our frustum has that size, and this tells us how large does our texture filter have to be. Yeah? So that's simple, that's linear. But now if lenses come in between, yeah, we have a ray here, and now it's refracted and refracted again, and now we hit. Yeah, now the size will be different, even if the distance that the ray passed is roughly the same. And okay, now the question is, yeah, can we describe that? Can we, while propagating the ray, always describe how large is this footprint that initially started here on the image plane? How large is that? Footprint of the ray at that point. And this is computed by ray differentials. And now this is maybe sounds more complicated than it is in the end. So there's a nice paper on that describing these ray differentials. It's already pretty old, and essentially it's implemented in every good ray tracer. And the idea now is the following. So let's assume, or we describe all the rays, or all the I rays in our system using a starting point, P, that's typically the camera, and then T times the direction, T is the ray parameter, and the direction D corresponds to the point on the image plane. Yeah, it's the direction of the eye ray. Okay, and we can describe that a bit more precisely. For a standard pinhole camera, we can say that the starting point is always the eye, and the direction, the direction we can compute using this UVW camera coordinate system. We spoke about that in the lecture about eye rays and ray tracing. So if we had that coordinate system UVW that spans the camera ray, so here's our camera, this is the image plane, and now we can express every direction of that ray as minus W. This brings us to the image plane, and then we have to take an offset in U and V direction to address the particular pixel. Yeah? So every pixel is addressed using something like this. X and Y are the pixel coordinates. Okay, and we have to normalize that vector. Okay, but that's, Good, so for every ray, we store this information, a starting point and the direction. And now the idea of ray differentials is not only to start these, to store these, but instead also to store the derivatives of the starting point and the directions with respect to the image coordinates. Okay, that's a bit complicated. Or this is something you have to get used to. So this just means take the image plane. Now we have this particular pixel, and we look at the ray through the center of this pixel. For now, we just take the center, So this is point x, y, And our ray looks like this, p plus t times, and then the direction that depends on x and y, This is the direction. For every x and y, we have another direction, and the starting point p is always the same. Now we can derive that for x and y. And if we derive the starting point, that's quite simple. In the beginning, that's always 0, because the starting point does not change with the position on the image plane. For the direction, that's different, It just tells us if I go a little bit to the right, how much does my direction change? And for y, it's the same, So essentially this, and this information essentially tells us how far the outer rays of that region are away from the center ray. How fast they diverge. And this is this information here. And in fact, we will later see on that this is not always 0. But if we have things like refraction in between and so on, we can also derive something similar for the starting points of the rays. Okay, good. So, that's maybe you have a vague idea how that looks like. Essentially, that really just tells us we are not only looking at a particular single ray, but also we are looking at the neighborhood. And in that neighborhood, how far does the direction and the starting position change? And for that example here, a standard ray just has here a constant certain derivative that tells us how fast do the rays diverge. Now we will see different steps, for instance, things like this reflection here. For these we will see formula that allow us to describe these rays after the reflection, that they diverge much faster. And we will derive that. And this reflection step here will result in a new ray where this is the standard reflection ray. And here we see that it just diverges much faster. Okay, good. So let's try to look at the simplest examples. I already a bit more complicated than what I showed here. So our standard iRays look like this. They have starting point E, and the direction is this here. Yeah, that's a point on the image plane. And now we can differentiate. I will always only differentiate for x, for y it's exactly the same. It works in exactly the same way. The starting point does not change, so the derivative is zero. And the direction, deriving that for u, for x gives us the vector u, and deriving for y gives us the vector v. But we also have that normalization step, and this makes things a little bit more complicated, and we end up with this formula. Yeah? So what is D in this formula? It's the direction and at the center. Yeah? Okay, I should have noticed that. So it's the main direction, so to say. Okay, but it is U. Yeah? So that's simple. Yeah? So now we know we have an iRay that starts at a point P with no variation. Yeah? All neighboring rays that we are interested in, they all start at P. We also know that our array has a main direction D, and how the other rays diverge, we know by the ray differentials. So this ray differential tells us if I go 1 pixel to the right in my image plane, what is the new direction for that pixel? Yeah? And this one tells us if I go one image upwards, how far or how much does this ray direction change with respect to the image plane? Yeah? So we can, by going a little step, so delta x into this direction, and delta y into this direction, and in fact not only delta x, but plus minus delta x and plus minus delta y, we can say this is our center ray. And now approximately this is the direction, so this has direction d. And this ray here, so if this is delta x, and this is delta y, then this ray will have direction, so x plus delta x, y plus delta y. Here we will have direction d plus delta x times this ray differential plus delta y times this ray differential. Yeah? It just allows us to approximate, if we change the starting point within that pixel, how do the ray parameters change? Okay, and so that's the starting point. And now let's assume this ray here hits a plane. Okay, bad start. So we have this point, this ray, and now we hit a plane. Okay, so what will happen now? So the hit point here will have some, here it will go further. So the hit point will vary because of that, because the direction varies. So do we have enough information to also compute now this for this hit point? So this hit point is P prime. Can we approximate where this hit point is? This is at x minus delta x, and this is at x plus delta x. And this is, in fact, the information that we want to have for this texture filtering. It approximates us the footprint here on that plane. And having these ray differentials, we can compute that now. The hit point looks like this. P prime is P plus T D. So T is the ray parameter for the hit point. So we can directly, or we can just derive this p prime, and now we get derivatives for the hit points, and they look like this. Yeah. So it's just deriving this, and because of of the derivation rules, we also end up with a derivative of t for x. Okay, that's a bit weird maybe to understand, but with some math, yeah. So this we know. This is the ray differential of the original ray. This one we know, yeah. These are the original ray differentials, but this one we do not know. And with some math, we can derive that. I don't need to go into details for that. And to derive that, what we need is, in fact, the orientation of that plane. So if that plane is directly facing, then obviously this footprint is smaller than if it's like that. So it somehow depends on this angle, yeah, between the face, or this angle here, between the ray direction and the normal. So we need to know that normal of the face. And so what is done here is that this ray parameter t is expressed by intersecting this plane with this ray, yeah, and that's up here, and we can compute the derivative of that. And computing, yeah, this derivative is exactly the derivative that we want to have here. And the nice thing is that in this derivative, suddenly this ray differential appears again. But this one we know it's exactly the same that we also have here. Yeah, it's again, this derivative is known, it's the ray differentials. And all the other things are known, the ray direction, the normal of the plane, the ray parameter for the intersection, all that is known. So we can plug this in. Yeah. This one we know. And that means for the new, for these points, again, we have ray differentials. OK, and this helps us to do texture filtering. Yeah, because for these hit points, or we now want to do a filtering, yeah, that exactly spans this range that is described by the ray differentials. OK, so we know the texture. So what we now want to compute is the range, or really the footprint, in the texture coordinates. So in our texture, we want to compute, yeah, or approximate that footprint. Yeah, this ray bundle that was emanating here, what size does this have in the texture? Typically, it will have a shape like this, maybe. Yeah, what size does this have? And for this, we first have to transform these positions, these hit positions, to texture coordinates. Yeah? These are not the same. But there's typically a linear mapping. We describe that with F. So this just maps positions to texture coordinates. And now for these texture coordinates, if we compute the differentials, yeah, we will end up with a term that contains this here. And this is exactly what we computed previously. Oops, where is it? Here. And we can again plug it in and compute that. And then we can compute the texture coordinates if we take image positions around our point. So what it ends up with is exactly what I've shown here. We have our pixel. We cast only a single ray through the center. Yeah. With this ray, we hit a surface here. Yeah. Then we compute these differentials, yeah, independent of how complicated they are. We compute these differential here. And what does that tell us? That tells us now, if I go a step into this direction, delta x into this direction, yeah, or let's put it the other way. Here in the center, when hitting that ray, I have a texture coordinate t. Now when moving in this direction by delta x. That means I change this ray direction. Yeah. Then I will hit another texture coordinate. And this texture coordinate will be at t plus delta x times this ray this texture coordinate differential. Yeah? So essentially, what that means is when we cast a single ray, we hit the texture here. Yeah? These differentials tell us a ray that is here on the right, or if we move to the right in the texture, we will walk into this direction. And if we just walk this distance delta x, we will end up here. And if we walk the opposite direction, we will end up here. And if we walk upwards, we will end up here. And if we walk downwards, we end up here. So these vectors directly span the range that will finally fall into this pixel. Yeah? So by computing these, we can directly compute this rectangle in texture space. Yeah? And this rectangle, not compute, approximate. Yeah? It's always only approximate. We can approximate the rectangle on texture space that will fall into the current pixel. So this one, or array through here, will approximately end up here. And a ray through here will approximately end up here, and through here will end up here, and through here it will end up here. Yeah, and that's cool. That's exactly what we wanted. There's quite some math in between, but it's standard formula. Yeah, you don't even need to understand them. They can just be implemented. Okay, good. So I hope some intuition about that, and even if the formula may be a bit tricky, the intuition behind that, I hope, becomes clear. So that would be a first application, yeah? Compute the size of the footprint. And I mean, essentially, that's MIP mapping. Yeah, we already had that. So you might say, okay, that's not exciting. There's maybe one difference, and that's if we have the following case, yeah, I have an object, and I'm looking on that object from a grazing angle. Yeah, what will happen is that my footprint here will become very long and thin. It will become something like this. Yeah, and this is something that we ignored up to now in MIP mapping. Yeah, we computed something like an average factor, and then we said, okay, I do not take this point, but I take a larger pixel of roughly that size. Yeah? But if you have something long and thin, these square filters for MIP mapping are not the right ones anymore. And this becomes visible. Yeah? If you're looking at objects from grazing angles, typically texture is then too much blurred. It's more blurred than necessary, at least in a horizontal direction. And there are ways to better approximate, or this method here now is a better way to approximate the footprint. Yeah, and this tells us, okay, in this direction I need to filter much stronger than in this direction. This is something that runs as anisotropic filtering or texturing. Yeah. And yeah, these ray differentials are the basis for that. Yeah, you need these to compute these kernel sizes. Okay, that's also what stands here. Good. But nevertheless, I mean, we are not much further than we were with standard MIP mapping. Yeah? But now we come to this example. Yeah? We haven't spoken about this reflection yet. And as I said, yeah, so this ray differential tells us how far these rays diverge. And now if we have a reflection at a non-planar surface, then obviously this divergence increases. And maybe you can even imagine how an object should look like so that rays converge again. In fact, for a single reflection, they just need to be concave. So if you have something like this, yeah, you look into something like this, then the rays are yeah, sort of reflected backwards, and suddenly they converge again. Yeah, it's a bit, little bit like this lens. So this also can happen. Yeah? So obviously reflection changes these ray differentials somehow. And yeah, in fact, this can be computed. Again, yeah, we can do these derivations, and we can accept the result. And this result just tells us that the new ray differential is the old one minus twice this term here. And now we have interesting, or the following parts are interesting in here. This here is the standard ray differential of the ray differential of the direction. This one we know. Yeah? This one is we always keep track. Then we have, okay, this scalar product, that's simple. That's just the scalar product of the ray and the normal of the hit surface. Yeah? So that's trivial to compute. And then we have here this term. We have it, the derivative of the normal. We have it here, and we have it here. And that's now interesting. Yeah, maybe some of you are a little bit more experienced with differential geometry, but even if not, it's not a problem. This one is essentially, or it's not the curvature, but it describes the curvature. So how fast does the normal change over the surface? Yeah. So if you have such a sphere, if you walk over the surface, then your normal continuously changes. Here it shows to this direction, here it shows into this direction. If you walk along the surface, your direction, your normal will change. And the smaller the sphere is, the faster it will change. Yeah? And of course, the other way around, the larger it is, the slower it will change. And in fact, this kind of measures the curvature. Yeah? How fast does the normal change? And how far or how the ray differentials change depends on the curvature. So if you have a very small sphere, then this divergence will increase. And if it's almost flat, I mean, also the Earth is a sphere, but we can well approximate it by a plane, even in larger regions, then it doesn't make a difference. But if the Earth would be very small, then it plays a role. And this directly comes in here. So this is the curvature of the surface, and this one, and this term kind of measures how curved the surface is. Yeah? So this term here now is used to make the difference between a ray hitting a plane. Yeah? For a plane, this term here will be zero. A ray hitting a sphere, for a sphere, this term will be positive. And maybe also that case, hitting such a concave mirror, then this one will be negative. Yeah? So this is the term that differentiates between these cases. And we don't need to understand that. With this formula, what we directly can do is that whenever we reflect a ray, we just take this formula to update the ray differential. That's all. Yeah? So we cast our ray, we hit a surface, we want to reflect the ray, we find out it's a reflective surface, so we reflect the ray, and so we update the differential for the direction using this formula, and then we have a new ray differential. Yeah? And we can just use that as before. So for instance, if we reflect this ray now, and here we have a sheet of paper with letters on it. Using this ray differentials, we can approximate the size in texture space using exactly this technique. Yeah? Now we hit that point here, and we can again compute that t, and we can compute the derivative of t with respect to x and y using this new ray differential that has been updated in here. Yeah? And as a result, if we have a plane here, we get a certain filter size here. And if we have a sphere, we get a larger filter size here. Yeah? And if we maybe have such a mirror, we maybe even get a smaller size because things are focusing again. Yeah, so it really tracks a long array how this divergence works. And for every hit point, we can compute the size of that footprint and can use that, for instance, for texture filtering. And this results in these images. Yeah. So what you can see now is that for here, in this region, now an appropriate texture filter has been used. And you see that the result is much better than it was before. Yeah? It's maybe a bit blurred or a bit unsharp at the boundaries, but the text is much better readable and more realistic than it was here. Yeah? So obviously here, for the sheet of paper, the right filter sizes have been chosen. But also for the same time, here through this glass, also the right filter size has been chosen. Yeah, and in fact, that's a very small filter because that sheet of paper is right in the focus. Yeah, so here a much finer resolution of the texture is used than here. Yeah, although the distance from the camera is the same. Yeah, and it's just by tracking these ray differentials while having. Okay, in that case, we don't have reflection, but we have refraction. And in fact, these formulas also exist for refractions. they become even more complicated, but it's still doable. And of course, then also the material property, the optical density, comes in. And yeah, it allows us to achieve this result here. Okay, so I think that was a bit... advanced, but I mean, we're at university finally. and maybe one or the other thinks, oh, wow, I find that interesting. I don't understand it right now, but I'm interested enough to think about that. And okay, in fact, the next section, we will continue having some formulas, and we will continue not in the context of ray differentials, but in that context of argumenting that we are not really interested in single points, but we always want to integrate over larger areas. And what we want to do next now is to formalize that process more. So maybe you remember, where is it? Very beginning. So here I said for distribution ray tracing of glossy planes, what we do is that we just cast new rays around the main direction. Yeah? And this gives us this glossy look. And the more we scatter these rays, the more blurry the reflections become. So in fact, it's our scattering, yeah, the algorithm, that controls the material or how this plane down here looks like. But if you have something like Phong, yeah, the interesting question is how can we distribute these rays such that they generate an image that corresponds to this Phong lighting model? And yeah, in order to do that, we really have to formalize now this entire process. And this we will do in the next chapter. We will look at this entire lighting process, indirect lighting, how light propagates through scenes, and so on. And we will put all that into one nice, rather short formula that fits into one single line. And that describes essentially the illumination problem. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not an equation that can just be solved. So only numerical solutions for this exist. And ray tracing, in fact, is one method to solve that equation. Okay, and yeah, since I was always over time in the last lectures, I think I can afford today to finish 15 minutes early, and we will continue then on Thursday with the rendering equation. Thank you.